people are looking for someone to blame for the falling oil prices, and you know, sitting legislators, you know, an easy target.
Primary voters oust incumbent legislators. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, can wildfires in interior Alaska speed up glacial melt in Juneau? Scientists are working to find out.
The glacier surface itself is basically layer upon layer of all those snapshots in time.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Alaskans ejected five incumbents from the House in yesterday's primary, and they also rejected two House members who tried to move up to the Senate. But not many Alaskans showed up to vote. It was the lowest turnout for a primary in state history. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau reports on what the results mean for the legislature.
Three Republican incumbents and two Democrats who caucus with the Republicans trailed their opponents in a primary that drew only 15% of voters, not counting outstanding absentee ballots. House Majority Leader Cherise Millett attributes both incumbents' headwind and the lowest ever turnout to the same factor, low oil prices that have hurt Alaska's economy and the state budget.
When you are in a deficit, I think people are, you know, it's depressing. People want to get out and vote for, you know, candidates that are upbeat, and it's hard to be upbeat in this environment.
A lack of highly competitive statewide races also contributed to the low turnout. Millett, who was unopposed, says it was a tough year to run for re-election.
People are looking for someone to blame for the falling oil prices, and, you know, sitting legislators, you know, an easy target.
It's not yet clear how the primary will affect the balance of power in the legislature. But if the current totals hold up, and Republicans continue to hold the majority, they will have to do so with two fewer Democrats joining them. That's because Bob Herron of Bethel was defeated by Zach Fansler, and Benjamin Nagiak of Barrow trails Dean Westlake of Kotzebue. Casey Reynolds edits the political blog The Midnight Sun. He says this year's special sessions kept incumbents in Juneau and away from their districts. With the apparent losses of Herron and Nagiak, he sees the chances of a bipartisan coalition increasing.
A bipartisan organization is more likely today than it was before the election. And the general election is going to be very important. I mean, that's it's really going to be the deciding factor on this one.
One Republican who showed a willingness to cross party lines lost. George Rusher defeated Republican Representative Jim Culver in a district that sprawls from Valdez through parts of Palmer to Big Delta. Business groups targeted Culver after he voted to reduce oil and gas tax credits. Rusher had said Culver was likely to join a bipartisan coalition with Democrats, but similar comments aimed at other candidates didn't succeed. In Palmer, Richard Best lost after making a similar charge against Delana Johnson, and Homer incumbent Paul Seaton won, despite, he says, being subjected to disturbing and unfounded charges.
The most negative campaign I've ever seen on the Lower Peninsula.
State Republican Party spokeswoman Suzanne Downing says the party has room for improvement in turning out voters in the November general election.
Every single district is, you know, could improve their voter turnout. And I think we're, as a party, that we're going to work a lot harder on that for the general.
The only legislator who isn't a member of either caucus, Eagle River Republican Representative Laura Reinbold, was reelected. The House Republican Caucus expelled her in 2015 after she refused to support a caucus-backed budget. She says she wants to rejoin the caucus and work with them to set their principles for the next term.
And all as I'm asking is that we stick with those principles. And that's why it's really important, the team that we send down there. And we're just hoping that, you know, we're lock and stick with, and make sure that we stand under the umbrella of our principles.
While most competitive races were in the House, The state's most expensive race was in an Anchorage Senate district, where Natasha von Imhoff defeated Representative Craig Johnson and Jeff Landfield. The State Division of Elections still has to count absentee and questioned ballots and won't certify the primary results for more than 2 weeks. With help from Ann Hillman in Anchorage and Shayla Farzan in Homer, I'm Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau.
That hotly contested race in the North Slope and Northwest Arctic borough has two Bush Democrats within 5 votes of each other. Incumbent Representative Ben Nagiak is slightly behind in his race against newcomer Dean Westlake. All precincts in that district have been counted, but the State Division of Elections still has absentee and question ballots to count. Westlake ran against Nagiak 2 years ago and lost by 131 votes. Nagiak declined to comment, and Westlake is out of reach at his fish camp. Nagiak is one of 2 rural Democrats targeted by members of their own party for caucusing with the Republican-led majority in the State House. House Democrats are hoping to build a bipartisan coalition next year. A challenger to the other Democrat, Representative Bob Heron, is winning that race. Zach Fansler has nearly 57% of the vote. There is one district left to report. Heron did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Fansler also has not responded. With no Republicans in either race, neither candidate will have a general election challenger. When it came to the federal races, Tuesday's election results held no surprises. As expected, Senator Lisa Murkowski easily beat 3 lesser-known Republican candidates. Murkowski was waving signs in Anchorage just before the polls closed.
I think we have the reality of a very, very strong campaign that worked from the very beginning to make sure that nothing was taken for granted.
Murkowski lost her primary 6 years ago and held her seat with a write-in campaign in the general. This time, she has raised about $7 million so far. On the Democratic side of the U.S. Senate race, candidate Ray Metcalf was well ahead of Edgar Blatchford. Murkowski's more formidable challenge may come from independent candidate Margaret Stock. Stock has raised $500,000 for her campaign and is seeking to get on the November ballot by petition. Congressman Don Young had no trouble in his race Tuesday. As per personal tradition, Young voted in Fort Yukon and was unavailable for interviews. None of Young's 3 Republican challengers raised enough money to file campaign finance reports. Democrat Steve Limbeck, though, has raised serious money to challenge Young.
It's going great. Lots of enthusiasm today. All kinds of people coming out. We're hearing lots of reports, people voting for me. It's exciting.
Lynn Beck, a former general manager of Alaska Public Media, spoke a few hours before the polls closed. He easily won his primary challenge on Tuesday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Eagle River couple has grand plans for a vintage airplane with a colorful history.
One of the pilots was using it to smuggle booze during Prohibition. Now that's character, and I think a lot of Alaskans can relate to that.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you've earned some college credits but haven't yet completed your degree, finish it now, online from anywhere. Online learning at University of Alaska Southeast provides courses in a format that is flexible for students working and raising families. Admission deadlines have been extended to August 19th. Apply now. Go to finishcollege.alaska.edu for more information. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
State House incumbent Dave Tallarico bested political newcomer Ryan Smith in the Interior House District 6 Republican primary. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, few differences divided the two candidates, who say they've become friends.
House District 6 sprawls across the state, encompassing Healy, Yukon Flat Villages, Tok, and the Richardson Highway, among other communities. Both Republican candidates call the western sector of the district home. Dave Tallarico is a former mayor of Healy and the incumbent for the district. Challenger Ryan Smith is an advisor for engineering students at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. With all the precincts counted, Tallarico handily defeated Smith Tuesday night by a nearly 200-vote advantage. Smith was not surprised by the vote, though he wishes the contest would have drawn out more voters. Only 6.5% of registered voters cast ballots in the race.
That's a dismal percentage of voters. Hopefully they show up for the general in November.
Smith says he's not upset by his loss. He calls Tallarico a good guy. He was spurred to run by the state's fiscal crisis, and he urges Tallarico to seek out oil industry advisors to tap the industry as a way to bridge the fiscal gap. Tallarico says he understands Smith's position, but says he'll push for precision cuts in the budget, not broad swipes.
I think maybe the toughest part for everybody is to prioritize what services we need to provide and at what level we need to deliver those at.
Tallarico, for his part, returned Smith's kind regards. He said he's made a new friend in him during the primary. In the general election, Tallarico faces Democrat candidate Jason Land from Salcha, and Jason Pratt of Salcha has filed to run as an independent candidate. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Perryville, a village on the Alaska Peninsula, has a new power generator. It will help Perryville use more renewable power and save on costs. Contractors have almost finished putting it together, but at the moment, it's almost 500 miles away from its destination. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
In an unassuming back lot in Anchorage, Alan Fetters is standing in a metal container about half as big as a mobile home. The inside is filled with machinery, wires, and colorful tubing, including three green diesel engines. This is Perryville's new powerhouse. And Fetters, who works for the Alaska Energy Authority, sounds a little like an auto mechanic as he shows off the shiny new John Deere generators.
So it'd be like having an old carbureted car you might have had, so somebody said like a VW Volkswagen Beetle versus a new fuel injected now. You get more power, you get more efficiency, it's cleaner emissions.
Perryville's new power system will also be better at using the power generated by the village's wind farm. It will get electricity to more than 100 people when it's up and running in October. It will also capture heat from the engines for the village school. A mix of federal and state money paid for the $3 million project. Sean Scaling, also of the Alaska Energy Authority, argues that's a reasonable price tag for reliable power in a rural village.
I mean, the size and the cost of this matches the community need. I think the fundamental point here is that you need reliable power. Everybody needs it and relies on it. And it's just got to be there all the time without failure.
Perryville Village Council Gerald Cosbrook says the old powerhouse, a wooden building with a rotting foundation, has generators that need to go.
One just went out last winter, and it's hard to find parts for them, and the one that went out actually couldn't be rebuilt anymore.
Through what's called the Rural Power Systems Upgrade Program, the Alaska Energy Authority has already fixed up dozens of powerhouses across the state. Dozens more communities like Lime Village, Whale Pass, and Kivalina are on the waiting list. In a few weeks, Perryville's powerhouse, which weighs more than 10 trucks, will be loaded onto a barge and shipped off to its new home. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
There's that saying, where there's smoke, there's fire. But where those dark plumes eventually wind up might surprise you. Scientists are wondering if the carbon released from interior fires is traveling all the way to Juneau, potentially speeding up glacial melt. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports.
Out on the glimmering white expanse of the Juneau ice field, a group of students and scientists are on an assembly line of sorts. It starts with Shad O'Neill, a glaciologist with the United States Geological Survey. O'Neill is twisting a metal tube into the snow and ice to take a core sample.
So you spin it down, it drills its way in, you turn it backwards to catch the snow, you pull it out, and you cross your fingers and hope there's something inside.
Wildfires are increasing in Alaska, a trend which has largely been attributed to climate change. Less snow cover can mean a longer wildfire season, and the southeast part of the state typically doesn't have to worry about fires. It's a rainforest, after all, but smoke can travel.
Natalie Kerwald, a USGS research geologist from Colorado, says glaciers will document that journey and more.
So it'll tell you if it was colder, it'll tell you if it was windier, it'll tell you if there was a lot of pollution during that time.
And it will reveal if carbon from wildfires is winding up on the ice.
The glacier surface itself is basically layer upon layer of all those snapshots in time.
Kerwald wonders if an increase in interior wildfires is spreading fine amounts of carbon on the Juneau ice field, which could accelerate glacial melt. She says that phenomenon has been documented on the ice in Greenland after the smoke from wildfires in western Canada swept across North America. And to see if the same thing is happening in Juneau, Kerwald is leading this team on the ice field to collect the coring samples.
So we'll just sort of jiggle it a little bit.
Chad O'Neill pulls up the metal tube. He releases a nearly perfect cylinder of snow and ice that's a couple of feet long. From there, a group of students from the Juneau Icefield Research Program go to work slicing it into sections, weighing it, and eventually smashing it to pieces with a mallet. They'll write down what section the sample belongs to, the deepest part being the oldest. The melted pieces will be sent to Dartmouth College, South Dakota State University, and the USGS in Colorado, among other places, to test what the temperature was when the snow fell and what traces of fire could be on the ice. Sarah Fortner is taking some of the samples back to Wittenberg University, where she teaches geology. She says in the science community, the trickle-down consequences of climate change is on everyone's mind. Ice cores from glaciers around the globe have been telling a sad story.
That's one of the ways that we know that climate change is happening and that it's related to our greenhouse gas production, because ice cores have preserved that record of increased greenhouse gases all around the world.
Scientists hope to determine if fire is affecting Juneau's ice later this year. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The village of Quinnahock has been hit with a rash of drug overdoses. One of the men from Quinnahock's four apparent heroin overdoses earlier this week has returned to the village. The other man has not yet returned. A third person, a woman, is dead. The fourth person was treated on site. Earlier, reports stated three overdoses, but as of Wednesday, Trooper spokesman Tim Despain says four overdoses happened within the same time frame. Patrick Cleveland, Quinnahock Tribal Administrator, says one right after the other, three people apparently overdosed on heroin Monday evening.
First person that was found was unresponsive, not breathing, lips had turned blue, and had to be revived with CPR.
A medevac picked up the man, and before the aircraft could land in Bethel, another overdose was called in. When the medevac brought the second man to Bethel, word of the third overdose reached them, but that person was already dead.
The young lady that passed was, I think she was just out of high school, and the two men are late 20s, early 30s.
Despain says the deceased was 19 years old. Cleveland says her body has been taken to Anchorage for autopsy. The fourth person, Despain says, was treated in the village and not flown out. When the fourth overdose occurred, has not been released. Cleveland says in the 700-person community, no one's unaffected by the tragedy. He says the overdoses have ignited anger at drug dealers and a drive for change. Michelle Matthew with the city of Quinnahock is organizing a community meeting today to discuss the issue of drugs in the community and what people can do about it. Her expectations run high.
I hope people get this sense of hope and fearlessness, because that's what's driving these drugs to run amok in our villages, because people are afraid to speak up, and now we are.
Matthew says the tribe is discussing placing extra security measures at its tribally owned airport, something she says has been brought up in the past. Cleveland says the WANT Trooper Division, the Western Alaska Alcohol and Narcotics Team, is in town investigating the overdoses, and a team from YKHC is expected to arrive today to debrief with first responders and the families. Former Eielson High School long jumper Janae Deloche just missed qualifying at the Rio Olympics. The 2012 long jump bronze medalist barely missed making the final cut during qualifying yesterday, falling a little over an inch short of the top 12 who advanced. Deloche was the last of four Rio Olympians with Alaskan connections to compete. Earlier in the games, Corey Cogdale, formerly of Eagle River, who won bronze in women's trap shooting in the 2008 Beijing Games, brought bronze in the event again. Women's rugby player Alec Kelter, also of Eagle River, was on the fifth place on the U.S. team. Three-time past Olympic medalist, former University of Alaska Fairbanks shooter Matt Emmons did not qualify for the final in the men's three-position rifle event. A lot of people wouldn't be all that excited about hopping in a wooden plane and flying thousands of miles. But in November, an Eagle River couple will do just that. They'll be part of a vintage air rally, flying an antique plane from Crete to Cape Town on a journey that will take more than a month. Alaska Public Media's Graylin Brashear met them to learn more about the adventure.
Nick and Lita Opegaard's story starts in the air. Lita was born and raised in Alaska, the daughter of a bush pilot. She grew up flying everywhere with her dad.
In fact, the first family vehicle that I have a memory of was our Stinson station wagon, a four-place single-engine aircraft.
Nick came to Alaska in 1973 as a young pilot just looking to get some experience. But flying for Ween Air turned out to be a life-changing job, and he stayed. And one day, he got up the courage to ask out a beautiful young flight attendant named Lita.
I was never going to date flight attendants. And I can tell you this, I've dated one now and I'll never date another one.
They got married a little over a year later. That was nearly 40 years ago. They've been flying together ever since. They're telling me this, appropriately, as we sit in seats pulled from a retired commercial jet in the corner of an old airplane hangar. We're at the Alaska Air Museum in Anchorage, surrounded by beautiful old planes that tell the story of flight on the last frontier. And the couple is about to embark on their own journey into aviation's past. They will make up one of only two American teams in a historic air rally in November that will see two dozen vintage aircraft fly nearly 7,000 miles from the Mediterranean to South Africa. When Nick first read about the Crete to Cape rally, he was entranced. He says to relive those glory days of early flight is something aviators dream about.
We all have a romantic side of us when it comes to flying. The days of barnstorming and flying in open cockpit airplanes over fields and pastures and waving at children whose eyes are as big as saucers looking up at these grand machines. I went home and ran this one up the flagpole with She Who Must Be Obeyed.
I said to him, boy, I think we can do this. Let's look into this further. So, of course, then we got on the mission of finding just the right airplane for us to do this in.
The plane they'll take off in is nearly 90 years old.
It is a 1928 Travelair 4000. There's pedigree with Travelair.
It was born during the golden age of aviation, built by a company whose three founders, Clyde Cessna, Walter Beach and Lloyd Stearman, all went on to give their names to other companies and other planes.
Its spars and ribs inside the wings are made of wood, and it's covered with fabric. It has a radial engine on it, and radial engines are those engines that you see that have cylinders sticking out in all different directions.
Nick's favorite story from its illustrious history comes from its days with the Newark Flying Service.
It was rented out to pilots. and the airplane was confiscated and sold at public auction because one of the pilots was using it to smuggle booze during Prohibition. Now that's character, and I think a lot of Alaskans can relate to that.
Getting the biplane across the Atlantic is itself a logistical feat. It'll be broken down in Florida and packed into a shipping container with special padding and cradles, and then shipped by sea to England and reassembled. From there, they'll fly across France, over the Alps, Italy, and the Balkans to Greece. Nick will make the 300-mile flight across the Mediterranean alone, swaddled in a survival suit. Lita will join him when he lands in Egypt.
Imagine flying in an open cockpit biplane down the Nile River by the pyramids, over the antiquities of Khartoum, by Kilimanjaro, over Victoria Falls, and flying out to the fascinating spice island of Zanzibar in the Indian Ocean right on the coast, and then landing in the great Serengeti Plain, ending the trip at Table Mountain in Cape Town, South Africa.
Along the way, they'll sleep in safari camps and attend Roaring Twenties themed dinners. Their packing list includes a sleeping bag and black tie attire. But what they're looking forward to the most is meeting people, locals, and their fellow adventurers.
In the various places we stop, it will be with great pride that we tell them that we are from Alaska.
The trip will take 5 weeks from the time they leave Crete on November 11th, and it is not without risks. But they're okay with that.
Well, hey, it's part of being alive. Mitigate the risks as best you can. Enjoy life. Enjoy the beauty of this magnificent planet, its people, and these wonderful flying machines.
They're pilots, after all, and Alaskans. You can follow their progress online come November. Links are on our website, alaskapublic.org. In Anchorage, I'm Graylin Brashear.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Rasha McChesney, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Liz Ruskin and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Graylin Brashear in Eagle River, Dan Bross and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, supporting Alaska's workforce and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The University of Alaska Southeast School of Management offers online college degrees for the unconventional student or working professional who wants learning on their schedule and timeline. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.